Movie Pod, a 32 Friends podcast. We discuss all things movies, past, present, and occasionally future. My name is Sammy Chester.
I'm Av Sinensky.
And I'm John Gilpatrick.
And today we are going to be talking about the movies of November 2021. I think this was the month where we finally turned the corner and got some really notable releases. I guess, you know, we'll get into which ones we loved, which ones we liked, maybe which ones we didn't like as much. My top 10 list is starting to now come into form a little bit.
Notable can mean notably good or notably bad,
I suppose.
Yeah, so it's pretty generous. John, you and I felt the same for October when Alf wasn't able to join us, which had feature of Dune, and then a number of other movies that we quite liked. And actually, it had a few movies like The Last Duel and Last Night in Soho. Didn't even get to then. We always say this is past, present, and occasionally future. Given that we are at November, we really just have a month to go to call it a year at the movies. What single movie that would qualify for 2021 are you most excited for? It can be something that hasn't come out yet. It can be something that you just haven't had a chance to catch up with. So maybe it came out in January. What would it be?
It's weird to not say the Paul Thomas Anderson movie because he's probably my favorite filmmaker. But for reasons I'll probably talk a little bit about later on, I'm like not quite as jazzed for Licorice Pizza as I probably should be. If you told me I could only watch one movie and the rest, like, you know, went into the garbage bin forever, probably
classic score,
I would probably just choose The Matrix Resurrections because I'm so curious as to like what that's going to end up being. I'm like a little bit of a defender of the second and third Matrix movies. I think the first is, you know, one of my probably 10 or 15 favorite movies of all time. So that is just, to me, is such like a curio that I can't feel myself getting more excited about anything else, even though I'm also like a little bit nervous for it too.
Matrix 4 got done a big buzz in the US. Like, do you see posters already? Is it on during football games, trailers or anything like
that? You know, I don't really pay attention to the commercials during the football game because there's a lot of red zone on here. And in terms of posters, there's none in my house, so I don't really see them anyplace else. I'd have to ask our city co-host. There's more going on.
Is Matrix getting this massive buzz that the franchise would suggest?
Not that I've seen much of. I enjoyed the first Matrix movie. It wasn't like quite as transcendent in my personal movie biography, for lack of a better word, as it is for like many other people out there for whom it was like transformative film. I didn't even bother seeing the second and third because everyone said they weren't that good. Considering doing like a full rewatch or watch in my case before number four, just because, you know, why not? It's not something that I'm like particularly anticipating. I too would have given the new Paul Thomas Anderson film Licorice Pizza as my most anticipated movie to come, but for the fact that I've already seen it. So no longer appropriate to be on that list. I'll choose the two movies that I'm really most looking forward to seeing coming out in December. One is going to be Spider-Man No Way Home, which I already have my tickets for the whole family. We're all really excited for that. Coen Brothers, The Tragedy of Macbeth. I honestly have no idea what that movie is going to be. I'm really excited both by, you know, the fact that it's the Coens, the fact that
It's just one. Yeah, only Joel, right?
Oh, right. I think
which is also really curious, weird.
It's written, directed just by him.
I think Matrix 4
only one of the Wachowski sisters is directing. Yeah. I don't remember which one. Funny that both those movies coming out like days apart from famous filmmaking duos are only solo efforts.
Bad month for siblings.
I guess so.
I'm going to sneak in two as well. I think maybe we all did. I'm not sure if it's even going to come out. It probably won't come out in the US certainly, but it's going to be a 2021 movie, which is the director of Portrait of a Lady on Fire, Celine Sciamma. So she has a movie that came out already in France this summer called Petite Maman, and it's been running the festival circuit Q3 and then in the last few months in the US. Portrait of a Lady on Fire had a big push in February, March. It was available and accessible enough, maybe because it had already been in theaters in France, that you could still see it in its given theatrical year. So I'm not quite sure where Petite Maman will fall. It's gotten rave reviews so far. And I wasn't familiar with the director before Portrait of a Lady on Fire. And as I think both of you know, that movie just completely wowed me. So I'm really excited for anything the director has next. And then the second one, also a foreign language. Look at me, double dipping in non-English movies.
Oh my gosh.
I know. This is an animated movie, though. It's a Danish movie produced by Jamie Lannister about an Afghan refugee living in Denmark. And it's called Flee, F-L-E-E. It came out earlier this year in a number of different countries. It's getting a wide release, I think, tomorrow in the US. So let me walk that back. I know that December 3rd is its US release. it's certainly not getting a wide release because it's
a Danish animated documentary.
A wider release.
I'm on board for anything Jamie Lannister shares with us. So if I could remember the actor's actual name, he's just a producer though. I don't think he has a speaking role in the movie. So those would be mine, but I think the ones you guys mentioned as well, I'm going to definitely see. Let's not get too far into the future. We are mainly about past and present. Give us some notables off.
One of the movies I'm looking forward to next month involves a king, and one of the movies that we're going to talk about right now, it does as well. That's King Richard Williams I.
The father of the basketball players. He has a bunch of famous sons. He's always on ESPN trying to sell Big Baller Brand. Or am I getting mixed up?
No. You're thinking of LeVar Ball.
LeVar Ball. This, of course, is the, Will Smith playing the role of Richard Williams, father of tennis sensations, Venus and Serena Williams. It had a release on HBO Max. It's also in theaters now. Like, had a blast watching this movie. I don't know about you guys. You know, I was a much bigger tennis fan back in the 90s than I am now. So this, like, really hit home with me. My dad is a big tennis player, and, like, we always used to watch tennis together when I was younger. And I, like, vividly remember, like, when the Williams sisters were coming up and just, like, how exciting it was to, like, to see a player like Venus Williams, who was heads and shoulders better than, like, anyone that we've ever seen before on the women's circuit. It really just, like, filled in a lot of blanks for me, much younger at the time and obviously much less attuned, you know, racial dynamics in sports the way they are today. Showcasing the ways in which they had to, like, penetrate this white world. I remember Richard Williams being this cartoonish character that was always mocked relentlessly on TV, and just, like, I guess seeing a different take on that, on, like, his perspective and the ways in which he was really trying to shield his daughters, all the baggage that could come along, all the pressures and the baggage, and just, like, family first story. And it's, like, a really pleasant, fun family movie. I would recommend this movie to literally anyone. I think this is just, like, so enjoyable, checked so many boxes. It's, like, a full recommend for me.
The reason I compared him to LeVar Ball is he's also a California African-American father who's very, very in the media and very much pushing his sons, who have also been extraordinarily successful, at least to date, not as successful as Venus and Serena Williams, but, you know, who will know? I never really understood who Richard Williams was, who he was vis-a-vis his daughters, who I only really heard about only once they were already successful. You know, I wasn't following Venus until she won Wimbledon, which I think was her first major. So I never really had a feel for Richard Williams. And then I kind of in my mind had, like, the shadow of LeVar Ball playing there, because LeVar Ball has been this sort of last decade pseudo version, you know, maybe inheritor of maybe what Richard Williams was for the 90s. Again, I don't know if it's a fair one-to-one. And obviously the sports are completely different in the sense of, you know, bringing a young female Compton, California, African-American to a sport like tennis is a whole different narrative than bringing a black male teen into basketball.
In my memory and in my mind, I thought of Richard Williams as a LeVar Ball type figure. And I don't know if that's just, you know, misremembering, or if just, like, that's what the media turned him into or what. His performance here, or the way he's portrayed here, is just, like, much more understated. The way he talks even has this awkwardness to it and shyness. He's kind of often talking in this monotone where he's, like, almost talking to himself than to others. That's just, like, really inconsistent with this, like, loud, colorful character that I remembered him as. And again, I don't know if that's just, you know, retconning or mapping LeVar Ball onto Richard Williams in some way.
What would you say is, like, Will Smith as Muhammad Ali versus Will Smith as Richard Williams?
You know, the other one you could throw into the mix probably to an extent is Concussion, where, again, like, a sports adjacent, he's got this, you know, very kind of in your face acting style. I think Ali is a better movie than King Richard. Will Smith feels very, very comfortable in this role. And I think that Ali, maybe it was almost too much for him at that point in his career, where he was really just, like, the biggest star in the world, but hadn't done so much of the dipping his toe in the serious acting at that point. It was really just blockbuster after blockbuster. And it feels like he chose this because he was ready, not because he had to do it. I have to wonder if the Academy is going to resist a chance to give him an Oscar.
Well, if we have Will Smith as King Richard going up against Denzel Washington as King Macbeth, talk about a movie, The Last Duel, that we'll maybe speak about later. That'd be an interesting mano-a-mano.
You know, no, I agree. That would be an interesting competition. I'm with Av. Every year there's one, maybe two, or it's just, like, I kind of give it as the default recommendation to everybody because I don't know your taste. I don't know, like, if you're going to be into the same Petite Mamans or Portrait of a Lady on Fires or Fleas or whatever it is that we're, like, kind of jazzed about.
But Spider-Man, I think that 3, like
right, like whatever it is,
two,
right?
Stuff like, whatever, like that.
This year, like, King Richard is, like, a really easy choice for that. Hard to imagine, like, people really not like at least appreciating the movie and the story.
I think the main kind of criticism, which is really not the movie itself, it's just some of the choices, is that Richard Williams as an individual, he had many kids outside of this marriage who he ignored effectively. And then the agency of Venus and Serena, particularly Serena, who's such a massive media quality today, the agency of the daughters is not this movie's concern very much. It's very much his agency while sort of putting to the side, I would say, some of the more negative elements of maybe the real life story. And I know, like, one thing you and I had discussed in the past once with Kiva Wienerker was like I, Tanya, and how much, talk about a sports adjacent movie, like how much you can sort of stomach I, Tanya in the way that it's, you know, telling a certain fractured version maybe of the truth.
For me, I came to the film from a similar perspective as Av, where like I used to be a big tennis fan. I remember Richard Williams kind of being this like very, very, I guess you could say, controversial figure. In my head, he was just sort of like a clown. And I think that the film like shows that a bit, but it's definitely more layered than that. When I found out they were making a movie about him, I was like, really? And then I found out that Venus and Serena, I think, were executive producers or producers, like they were involved in some capacity in the making of the film.
This doesn't feel like, no doubt, because the finger is on the movie, therefore it's giving like an overly positive Williams story.
I worried about that when I found out they were involved at all. I was just like, oh, so this is like the approved version of the story. Mm-hmm. You really do get a sense of all the different layers to who this guy was and what drove him. And I think that the fact that it's called King Richard and it's the Venus and Serena movie, I think it's probably appropriate and does a good job at, you know, making you understand what made him tick without necessarily making you sympathize with him or his perspective at all. I don't think that there's any like easy heroes or villains necessarily. Obviously, I think you can say Venus and Serena are heroic in real life, but in the movie, they're still really kids by the end of it. Don't get so much of their story. It's really about him, probably his wife, secondly, and the kids after that.
Sammy, you and I watched a bunch of tennis movies a couple of years ago and we did our
this podcast has more credibility to talk about sports movies than probably any other,
especially tennis movies. We watch basically every tennis movie that exists, and this is by far like the most cinematic portrayal of tennis that I've ever seen. Those like tennis sequences just like felt like vibrant and alive. The stakes felt so high on every single point, whether even like in the practices, just I mean, I don't know how much like CGI they used or, you know, other sorts of tricks, or like whether or not, you know, actors were like were trained in tennis, but like they were like their form was perfect. They just like looked like complete naturals out. It was really incredible to watch.
A quick question to test your memory of tennis sports movies. When we watched them, we noted how there's a single character, a real life character, who is pretty much in every single tennis movie. His name, or he's actually on screen. There's several tennis movies that are only about him, and he also appears in this movie for about 2 minutes.
Yeah, John McEnroe, of course.
Yeah, of course.
And, from Never Have I Ever, and well, from Enthusiasm.
The second that McEnroe was in this movie, and he's like barely there, I was just like, oh, he has to be here. They're like checking off the tennis movie criteria of you have to have McEnroe in your movie for, you know, some split second. I put this up there with Borg versus McEnroe and 7 Days in Hell, and now King Richard, and not in that order, are now my three go-to tennis movies, and a pretty good three head-to-head versus, I think, a lot of sports. This is certainly, to me, a sports movie, and that, to me, is really a large part of its success and its failures. It has a lot of that kind of wholesome, overcoming great odds, competition, true life tales of renowned sports stars. It has that like good sports movies have, but it also kind of locks us into needing some sort of big game to sort of tie the movie up. And I don't think it really fits the flow of the story. They're getting us to, will he kind of let go of the strings and I guess let his daughters take on their own agency, which does make sense as the ending of the movie. And yet, even though that is kind of where the movie is going and maybe what it's suggesting, they bring us in, as Av, you were just mentioning, into sort of a big game, like the finals of Venus's first pro tournament, or maybe the semifinals, I can't remember. I just didn't feel that we needed really that sports movie stereotypical big game ending. It felt a bit forced. This movie also has a wonderful script. There was one line particularly, he's at this club and he sort of references the hoods. He's like, oh, did you guys leave your hoods at the entrance? Just all these like little lines there that you kind of go, oh, the director, Ronaldo Marcus Green, he directed Monsters and Men, which was one of our.
Yes, I thought of you.
Av and I had done a special on sort of like Black Lives Matter movies, and that's one of the best of them. And I think this is his biggest movie to date. He's a really good director, so I'm not surprised he managed to make something special here. There's only one other movie I've seen so far this year, which maybe we'll talk about in a moment, which would compete with this head-to-head for, you know, 5 stars on Wholesome.
I really like John Bernthal, plays the one of the
coaches. Florida coach? He's the coach of Florida.
The Florida coach.
He's so good in this. He's so good.
Yeah, I thought he was great. I haven't seen him, so like, kind of talked about much, but his presence was just delightful. I thought in the movie he was terrific.
Yeah, he sounded like Bob Odenkirk.
Yeah. Will Smith wears those like short shorts and the high socks. He just like wore that outfit to kind of validate and push this miraculous story of taking these two all the way to the heights of the sports world. You know, it all started with those short shorts. And Will Smith wears them with pride very tightly. You know what I was talking about when I said there's another movie that's super wholesome from this month?
I assume you're talking about Belfast, the Kenneth Branagh movie.
I watched this movie with my wife, and suffice to say, at some point she said, is Gilpatrick part of the script? Because why is it on the screen at all times? So I'll leave that there. You know, we have a lawyer on the line, so I don't want to get us in trouble. But
I think we'll be okay.
Given we have a Gilpatrick, and I don't know where your family's from originally, what did you make of Belfast, and is it as wholesome as Av and I are suggesting?
Family's from Ireland, not Northern Ireland, as far as I know, but my name was there because I actually wrote Belfast. Didn't direct it, but I wrote it. It's going to make it kind of awkward when I kind of trashed the movie because I didn't like it.
Your family are the ones who left, but the ones who don't care to
That's it. They edited around all my favorite parts. Written, directed by Kenneth Branagh, also well-known as an actor from, you might recognize him as Lockhart from Harry Potter.
And the Thor movies.
Movies, right? He directed, I think, the first one. I think a semi-autobiographical story about him growing up in Belfast in the late 1960s when there was
the troubles,
the troubles going on between the Protestants and the Catholics. The sort of cipher as a child is this boy named Buddy, who's played by a newcomer named Jude Hill, and we follow him and his ma and pa and his granny and his pop.
So what didn't you like about it? Because it sounds like you had issues with the movie.
Did not care for it. I kind of worried that I might not care for it, and I mentioned a little bit earlier on that like I'm having a little bit of trouble getting like super excited for licorice pizza. I just really don't care for coming of age movies, and I think this is like sort of like the worst example of the things I don't like about it. I found it like very self-indulgent. I think probably because it is autobiographical, it's going to recall for a lot of people Roma, the Alfonso Cuarón movie, because it's in black and white and it's about somebody who's sort of living
semi-autobiographical about his
and in this place where there's also political conflicts kind of bubbling in the background. I think Roma is like the best version of this movie.
Roma is much better than Belfast.
Well, so I don't really like, I think Roma is fine. I don't love Roma that much.
I agree with you. I don't love Roma either, but I think Roma is 10 times better than Belfast.
Well, I agree with you there. I think Roma, you know, is a good version of this. I think this movie is Roma crossed with Jojo Rabbit, which is another movie that I really don't care for. It just feels to me that you could make a movie about somebody living in Belfast at this time and interesting for like an adult, but because you want to like shoehorn in coming of age story of like a really young kid, then you're getting like an infantilized version of Protestant Catholic conflict in Northern Ireland. Just bothered me. And then I think that the coming of age stuff is like way too cutesy for my taste. Like, I don't love like the high school coming of age stuff as much, or whatever coming of age. Like, it's just like a subgenre that I really don't like connect with. But like when you're making it about a really young kid, I'm just like, I don't know. Don't have any kids. I have a hard time like relating from the world from their perspective. Because I'm like, you know, I was a kid, like I like whatever. Like, I don't feel like I need to reflect on like the world as it was at that point. I feel the need to do that from Kenneth Branagh's point of view either.
I was sort of agreeing with John about the Roma comparison, but I like Belfast and I liked it in the following sense. I don't think it's a great movie. It's very wholesome and it's very like family dynamic, and I just wanted to spend time with that family. The lead is just cute. He's not really there. He's just there to like interact with everyone else. But his parents, particularly his grandparents, they're just winning. And I just wanted to, meaning winning, like I like spending time with his pops, his grandpa. I like spending time with his grandma.
The pop the most, would say.
Sierra and Hines, the king of the wildlings, I suppose. I liked interacting with the people that he interacts with. And that would be a comparison to a movie I know we're going to speak about in a moment, which I think is a much more challenging movie in passing. why I actually like Belfast better than Passing, even though it's much less challenging in terms of the content, is the characters in Belfast to me are much more fleshed out. They're much more lived individuals. And I felt that from the parents and the people in the neighborhood and the grandparents. Compare this to Passing, as they're both black and white movies. I don't think Belfast really benefits so much from being in black and white. They do have a cool trick they do where when the family goes to see movies, the movies are in color, which is done nicely. But I think the movie as a whole would have benefited actually from being maybe in some sort of a faded out color scheme, if you know what I mean, that we've seen movies like that. But like, I don't think it needed to be in black and white. And I don't think it even compares very well to, what was the name of the movie? Minari? Somewhat similar, like a cute grandparent, the parents are having conflict, a very cute little boy lead that's about the same age. But certainly Minari, I think, is a much better movie, is a much more challenging and richer movie that I'd recommend more than Belfast. We talk about sometimes, what's the difference between movies, what's the difference between TV? To be fair, there was a clear difference between the two mediums, you know, 40, 50 years ago. But notice how in this movie, they only make the movies in color, not the TV. When they're watching TV, it's still in black and white.
I wasn't a huge fan of the black and white either, although it kind of does pay off in that like one moment where they're in the theater and all of a sudden that's in color. Like, it was exciting. Obviously, that doesn't justify making, you know, a 90-minute movie in black and white for like a 45-second color payoff. I quite enjoyed this movie. I wouldn't like rate it as like one of the, you know, best movies ever. I don't think it was nearly as good as Roma. And the, you know, the comparisons to it are obvious, including the big, you know, movie scene in the middle. They also go see a movie in Roma, right, in the middle of the scene. But yeah, I mean, like, I kind of just like really like the way that it just like captures the childlike innocence. The political turmoil is just like happening in the background. Like, the kid doesn't even really understand why his parents are considering leaving Belfast. And like, of course, this is the only place he knows. They don't really seem that interested in the politics either. Like, they're just like kind of trying to live their lives, remain indifferent to like, I guess, the competing sides and narratives of whatever is happening, which I'm not that educated on either. Found that really interesting, I guess, just because of like my own personal background and like having had grandparents who lived through, you know, obviously tremendous turmoil, and like, probably like they were kind of like in a similar position to an extent of just like, we don't know what's going on. We don't necessarily care what's going on. Just like, leave us alone. Like, we just want to like live our lives. That perspective and that kind of just like nostalgia and this like love letter, you know, his family and like the sacrifices that they made and the resilience that they made to persevere through an experience like this, I just like found pretty affecting.
I think I probably would have enjoyed, just from the parents' perspective, navigating the politics of the era and trying to decide what to do with their young children, right, more than I enjoyed the boy just kind of watching and not really being sure about what's happening. And I felt like we got sort of 101 version of how complex the problem was, because it had to be told from the child's perspective. And I get that that's sort of the point. There's a better movie about this time period that I think I would have appreciated. It wasn't shoehorned in with, I'm Kenneth Branagh, this is me as a child.
I think it kind of connects to Passing, the movie that I was referencing, because the director of Passing, who's, you know, the force behind the movie Existing, also has sort of an autobiographical connection to the story, also set in the past, the 1920s, and in New York City, of course.
Directed by Rebecca Hall. I don't know her personal connection to it.
Rebecca Hall is, you know, is not African-American, but her mother was, you know, someone of mixed African-American, I guess, white background. And so she sort of identified through her mother, and then I think through her mother's family, this legacy. Ruth Negga and Tessa Thompson also come from sort of mixed ethnicity background.
They're both like, you know, fairly like light-skinned black women. They walked into a room, like, you wouldn't think that they're, I don't know what they're like. Should we be talking about this?
Yeah. No, I mean, the director from her family and both actresses are all in their own sort of way drawing off autobiographical insight into that theme of the movie.
The movie, in short, basically is like traces the stories of these two women, Claire and Irene. Claire, played by Ruth Negga.
We can just call them Negga and Tessa Thompson. I can't remember their names.
Yeah. The movie starts out with like where the two of them bump into each other in like club or, you know, dining room in Chicago somewhere. And what we learn is that they were childhood friends. They're both African-American. Tessa Thompson's character is trying to pass as white in order to like get into this club that she's at. And what we learn is that Ruth Negga's character has been passing as white for like the last 20 years of her life. So much to the point that she's even married to a white man who has no idea that she has
a very racist. He must be played by what family of actors?
It's Alexander Skarsgård.
He had to be a Skarsgård. Just like, I was like, oh, that's a Skarsgård, of course. The lanky way he rolls into the movie, I was like, oh, yeah, it's a Skarsgård.
This movie was really fascinating to me on multiple levels. I would say that like the first half of this movie was possibly on track to be my favorite movie of the year, because I was just like so mesmerized by it and just like found it so fascinating that like this is a thing that people do, and like the dynamics of that, and like the black and white color palette, I think really enhances the experience of just like the concept of passing. Because like if this movie was shot in color, like us as the viewers would not be at all be able to buy the possibility of, you know, either of these women passing as white, like in our modern society. But like the black and white visuals really, you know, kind of like puts us in the position of, you know, like the other passersby. The movie kind of, to me, just goes off the rails a bit in the second half, where it just becomes like a much more conventional, weird love triangle movie, which is like not at all what where I expected it to go. Like it kind of really like moves away from the racial tensions and like, you know, all the dynamics around that. I still overall really enjoyed it just because I thought the first half was like so magnificent. As I said, this was like on track. I mean, I'm my number one movie of the year, and it might still make my top 10 or like, you know, around there. But I would definitely say like the back half of it really hurt its standing for me.
I was somewhat similar to you. I hadn't really noticed it until you said it now, and I think you're right that it's kind of a first half, second half, in that the movie's tension ends up being much more about jealousy rather than something kind of fundamentally racial. Racial tension was more interesting, and a jealousy tension, you know, something we've seen tons of times, which is two erstwhile friends. There's the blonde girl who's hot and popular and takes risks, and there's the withdrawn brunette who, you know, is sort of jealous of her. That just feels like a story, you know, Archie comics that we've seen spelled out endless times. And I know this is based upon source material, a book written in the 1920s. The other part for me, and I'm curious, John, how much for you this was a concern, I found Nega's character fascinating. And to some extent, she gets to be the more mysterious character. To my mind, it was very, because maybe the setting in New York City in that era, it was very kind of Great Gatsby. And I felt that Nega gets to sort of be Daisy Buchanan and Jay Gatsby rolled into one. She's sort of both of those kind of archetypes.
I think it's a great observation. Yeah, I totally agree.
She's both of those characters, really. And both the actresses are good, but really Nega, who again has like the more mysterious kind of sexy role, she really knocks it out of the park. And therefore, part of the problem for me is that the protagonist in this movie is really Tessa Thompson. The problem as a result is that we just spend a lot of time with Tessa Thompson, who I think does a good job in the role, but her character is fundamentally kind of bland. She doesn't want to talk about race. She doesn't want to talk about politics. She doesn't want to go out so much. She doesn't want to, you know, and she's just very buttoned in. Spending a lot of time with a character that's not as interesting, I think all the characters aren't really fleshed out enough in comparison to Belfast as like real people. I just ended up feeling that I was kind of with paper caricature of Tessa Thompson's character. Too much of the movie was spent with her. So the lack of that complex, challenging racial tension, and then the characters as a whole, particularly Tessa Thompson's character, it ended up kind of sinking the movie. So it's a movie I'd recommend, but you know, not like a wow movie for me by any means.
It was a wow movie for me. Probably currently my favorite movie of the year. After I watched it, it was just totally caught me off guard. Like I wasn't expecting to like it as much as I did. Yeah, I definitely agree with Av in the sense that the first half of it, never really seen a movie about something like that before. And it did feel sort of challenging and unusual and not, how do I really feel about this? Where is this going to go? The thing that changes about it is it like sort of turns into for like 45 minutes or so, just like a hangout movie. Like a hangout movie in these clubs in Harlem in the 20s, like Prohibition era, funky costumes. And that's something that like I also like wasn't expecting and kind of enjoyed, even though it was like a jarring shift. And then the shift back to, yeah, to kind of bring it all together, it happens so suddenly. And
yeah,
is also drawn out a bit though. And like, I feel like drawn out, like really worked in its favor because like the dread really built. There's this sort of like pre-climax where they're like walking up the stairs to this apartment and you just sort of like know what's happening.
It's very much foreshadowing.
Like, yeah, it's like Chekhov's staircase.
Yeah.
I liked all of that. Like to me, like the movie felt like a John Cassavetes movie, which I don't know if either of you are fans of his or have seen many of his movies. This is like 2021's letterboxed, very like stylized Cassavetes movie about two like light-skinned black women passing as white. It's just like, whoa, that is a wild description of a movie. In the end, I was taken by all of that. I do definitely agree that Ruth Negga's character she has a lot more pizzazz. So the performance, I think, gets to be showier. But I think Tessa Thompson, like, there's more going on there than might appear. And the performance, I think, is really good. A great performance in a fine role. At one point, Ruth Negga asks her, like, what is it that you want? She's like, I have everything I could possibly ever want. And she says it like with the least amount of conviction that somebody has ever said anything in a movie ever. And it's just so sad. You're watching her realize how untrue that is over the course of the film. And I found that compelling.
Something that I think the movie wants to do, and it just didn't hit the chord with me as much. I think this back half of the movie is trying to say, oh, now they're like, Negga particularly is passing in Black society where she doesn't really belong, so to speak. And so that's sort of the rebound passing that's going on. And then that's having Tessa Thompson's character say like, oh, you know, do I really belong here? Am I just sort of passing through this life as sort of a perfect mother, as an ideal mother, but not really fitting in? So, you know, I guess that's how it's trying to sort of have its kind of double and tertiary layers of what it means to be passing as particularly a mother. A Black mother. Maybe I'm also a bit of an audience where like I don't appreciate some of that enough. I read up on Wikipedia a bit that the book is, you know, has this like deep impact feminist literature for what does it mean, you know, as sort of the unhappy mother and, you know, the Black woman in society. So, you know, maybe there's layers there that I just didn't appreciate enough in that back half of the film.
I had the opportunity to listen to the post-show recaps theater episode that they did on this movie, a podcast hosted by Ariel and Grace from post-show recap they had on Chappelle. He obviously had a lot to say, given the subject matter, that I think is worth checking out, someone with, you know, a more personal experience on these types of issues. I also, Grace had a lot of personal experiences to share on the ways in which like the concept of passing maps onto the trans experience. So like both of those perspectives I thought were really, really interesting. So if you see this movie and you want to kind of hear from people that are probably a little bit smarter than us and, you know, a little bit more personal experience to share on, you know, the subject matters of the movie, I would definitely check out post show recaps on that.
I won't go into spoilers, but I know it's kind of trying to leave a bit of vague who's responsible for what at the end, but I actually thought the movie, I actually went back and watched it a second time, just like the very last bit to see for myself. I thought the movie seems to have a much stronger stance if you look at sort of how other characters are reacting to what happens at the end as to who's responsible. So I'll leave it there because I don't want to spoil the ending. It sounds like the ending came as a surprise to both you guys.
Yeah, I think that's fair.
Maybe you want to go first. Is there anything you really want to kind of get off your chest from November?
Yeah, I'd rather talk about Spencer because I know this is a movie that you have very strong opinions on. And I think maybe not squarely on the other side of this, but certainly more on the other side than on the same side as you.
Spencer is the movie about Princess Diana in I think the year 1991, basically this Christmas vacation. When she came to the conclusion that she had it being a part of the royal family. I think she separated 6 months later and then she divorced, you know, whatever it is, a few years later. And like Princess Diana was like the dominant female public figure of my childhood. Our generation maybe doesn't appreciate that because we were very little then and, you know, years have passed since then. Spencer is her maiden name, and that's what this movie's about. The same director has a movie which has been getting a lot of comparison to, which is Jackie, where Natalie Portman plays Jackie Kennedy. I really, really liked Jackie. The film work of these two movies is similar. The director has a very heavy hand in how he does. He's a very clear way of how he does things. And I can appreciate that. I don't dislike that. That's what works for me, frankly, in Spencer. The two things that really don't work for me in Spencer. One is that the symbolism is so heavy handed, like name tag on the clothing, and the clothing itself, almost every scene, every like animal she interacts with, almost every other line of the script is repeating like metaphors over and over and over. And it rams it into our heads. And the movie's just so non-subtle. And it's laid on so thick. I was like, I get it. That's the one thing. And then the second thing, she's very non-sympathetic. And it's very easy almost to watch Spencer and to say, wow, like she's so spoiled, like driving up in her like fancy car and then just pouting the whole movie and then like driving off. And my wife, when I told her this, said like, you're an asshole. Because she said like, I'm not being appreciative enough to like,
I agree. You're an asshole.
So like, you know, and look, that was one of the reasons that women loved Princess Di, you know, because she was caught in this impossible situation and women empathized with that. So maybe I'm not empathizing enough with it. So that was, I thought the movie made it hard to empathize with her because I felt she was portrayed very unsympathetically. But then the main thing is I felt like a lot of the movie's message is that challenge of royalty having a public versus private life. And I just feel that message is literally the message of every single movie and TV show about the British royal family. And we've had so much of them over the last decade, whether it's books or whatnot. I get that message. Your symbolism is heavy-handed. I'm done with this movie.
I will say, this movie to me is not nearly as good as Jackie. I thought Jackie was a masterpiece. I agree with you that there is a stylistic similarity and a thematic similarity that like they're in many ways like two versions of the same movie about fairly similar characters in some ways. And they both like thematically are like the deconstruction of a fairy tale, you know, the former being like this notion of Camelot and like the public image of what we saw versus what was really going on behind the scenes. You can say like there are people who have gone through what Princess Diana went through, the exact same thing and a million times worse. And she also is a super wealthy princess.
But I'm saying it's so well known. The story of Princess Diana having to go through that is so well known. Jackie, it wasn't as well known, I think. And therefore, the movie was more revelatory. I just feel Princess Diana's story has been told by 1,000 books, numerous documentaries, a few movies, maybe not. Was there anything new in Spencer?
Yeah, so maybe not. I mean, I haven't watched The Crown and I haven't watched those other documentaries. So maybe that's the disconnect here, is that to me, this was interesting. I wasn't that educated on her and like, you know, the specifics here. Something about the idea of someone who wanted to be a princess and now all she wants to be is a mom that I found very powerful. That like, obviously this is like the main theme of the movie, but like that line ex-husband says, like, you know, they don't want us to be people. Like we're just supposed to be these like, you know, symbols and like kind of like separating the public versus private. That was all very powerful. I really appreciated that.
I do think one of the things I liked so much about Jackie, and I agreed with Av, I think that movie's a masterpiece. Favorite movie of the year it came out was that 2016, I think. Yeah, I mentioned with King Richard that there's like always a movie that I kind of recommend to people. And it seemed like for whatever reason, like I wasn't recommending Jackie to a lot of people that year because it was so like out there in terms of what it was. But I think people were like, oh, the Jackie Kennedy movie, like that'll be great. I watched it like 4 times, like in a month. I watched it myself, then I watched it with my wife and she didn't really care for it. Then my parents wanted to watch it and they hated it. And then I watched it with my in-laws and they hated it. And so it was just like the opposite of the like movie I'd recommend to everybody. Yeah. So I think I'm kind of in a similar position with Spencer this year. I haven't watched it yet, but I'm like, I don't think I'm going to recommend this to anybody, even though everybody's like, oh, I want to see the Diana movie. I'm like, okay. Yeah. Anyway, one of the things you said was just like that besides like just sort of telling the story about this woman, like there's not really much going on otherwise. And I do think one of the things that I like so much about Jackie was, it was telling the story of Jackie at this like shocking time. So much of it was really more about sort of how we write our own stories and how history gets told, I think in a lot of ways. And you had the framing device in that movie about her with the interviewer and kind of like standing her ground and knowing exactly what she wanted to say and how she wanted to be said and other conversations and things she was doing to make sure that when her husband was remembered, it was this way and not that way. And so I hope that I can get something like that. It doesn't have to be that, but it has to be something more than here's Diana's tough day in the country. Maybe you didn't. It sounds like maybe Av kind of did.
I think what the movie tries to have is Timothy Spall, who last month in the Malta movie, in this movie is trying to be some faint version of what John Hurt played as the priest. Jackie.
Yeah.
Now, not the same role, but I think like they're trying to set him up as kind of the wise old man who in this movie he's antagonistic toward the princess, as opposed to sort of a listening ear and a challenging ear as the priest is in Jackie. But although Spall is fine, he's just very flat. I mean, like Spall's role basically is just to walk up there and be like, do your duty. I was once a soldier and I didn't do it because I loved my officers. I didn't do it because I loved the queen. I did it because I did it for England. I did it for the idea of the royal family. So you should like pucker up and have a stiff upper lip and do it for like the idea of England. And I'm just like, again, like,
this like comes at a moment, like right after I just watched the, impeachment American Crime Story. And like, there's a very similar through line, you know, of that story and this one. And like the way that these women were just tortured by the media, all, you know, the gaze put upon them for like really no good reason other than like people decided that they should be public figures, going through like the worst turmoil of their life and like literally ended in her death because of what was done to her. I just found that all very powerful, you know, enjoyable experience. I mean, maybe enjoyable is not the right word because it's like kind of this fairy tale flipped into a horror movie in a lot of ways. And a lot of that is done through the what I thought was incredible Johnny Greenwood score here. The way it's, you know, switches moods and creates this like feeling of claustrophobia and horror at times, and it's like, whimsical and like magical at other times. I thought that was really well done.
I didn't realize Johnny Greenwood scored this one because the composer for Jackie was Mika Levy, and I sort of assumed that they were reuniting, but I guess it's not the case this time. I love Johnny Greenwood, but
I could be wrong, but I thought that was the case.
I'm not sure. I know Johnny Greenwood did score The Power of the Dog as well, which I think we'll talk about next month.
John, the one thing is you have to see Emma, which is this director's other 2021 movie, and then catch up with Spencer and then tell me how you think the two of them compare. I like Emma more. Emma's very different than Jackie and Spencer.
Let's go from feuding royalty in Spencer to dueling aristocrats in the Middle Ages with the movie The Last Duel. Matt Damon and Ben Affleck co-wrote and co-star with Adam Driver and Jodie Comer in a Ridley Scott epic about a real-life middle-aged duel to the death between two knights that resulted from one accusing his rival of raping his wife. This movie had the scope, setting, and cast to be my favorite of the year, and yet it simply doesn't live up to what it should have been.
Did it work for you or did it not work for you?
It did not work for me, and the main reason it did not work for me is that because the gimmick that it uses of this like Rashomon device where it tells this story of the Matt Damon's wife's rape by Adam Driver is what's going to lead to this last duel between Matt Damon and Adam Driver. So like it sets up where we see the story from three different perspectives, the two males, and then from her perspective, ends up just being completely useless. Like there's no reason for that to be the structure of the movie. Like this movie would have been potentially much better if they just like told the story in a normal way, like beginning to end sequentially, added more meat on the bones to like character work and that sort of stuff, based so much around this, like he said, she said, and the truth, and then like isn't enough differences between the versions of events to make it interesting that like you're kind of left with like, well, why did you go to the trouble of doing that? This could have either been like a 45-minute movie or made a longer version of like a sequential story. It just like it added nothing to the story at all.
I see what the movie was trying to do, and I think it could have done this.
It was like I was watching the same story three times with like very slight nuances.
Yes. And as a result, it becomes an almost 3-hour long movie, which is emphasized because you're watching the same story so many times. So the second part is Adam Driver, who in 2021 is making a role as being a sexual abusive male. The second part is Adam Driver's perspective. And the third part is the wife's perspective, Jodie Comer, who I think Jodie Comer is really good at this. I think she's by far the most dynamic. I think the second and the third really had to have a much stronger distinction between them, because Adam Driver in the second has this one key line, which should have been fleshed out throughout the second perspective, which is where he's speaking with Ben Affleck's character. And he says, sure, I had sex with her, but it wasn't rape. It was just, you know, we both enjoyed it. And she only objected in the way that a woman must object. And I think that line is really the soul of kind of what his perspective is supposed to be. You know, just this deep sense of entitlement, which I think rings true all the way through today. And you can see it, whether it's these college cases or the Supreme Court cases, or, you know, the way our system is legislating, you know, out abortion or whatnot. And but we didn't get that enough from Adam Driver's section of the movie. Like he has that one line, but that the theme of that line really had to color much more of the way he was portraying and engaging. And what represents that the best, the sexual assault scene, is pretty much scene for scene exactly the same in Adam Driver's portrayal. And then when we see it for the second time in from the wife's perspective, from Jodie Comer's perspective, they needed to have from Adam Driver more of his sense of entitlement, more of his sense of women just are sort of after me, and of course they want this, and you know, this kind of like white male privilege, frankly, that needed to be, I don't want to say heavy-handed, I don't know if he made a choice to be very, very subtle. I know Ben Affleck wrote Adam Driver's kind of section of the movie. I don't know whether to call it too subtle or just, as you said, just not different enough.
I was really excited for it. I mean, the director, the cast, the subject matter, you know, the Rashomon, you know, storytelling. I was really pumped to see this movie. And like, I really liked like the first hour of it. And then like when it just kept being like, oh, we're just going to do that again. And then like, oh, we're doing it a third time. Okay, I see. It just fell really flat for me.
Yeah, the setting is amazing. The acting is pretty good. And Jodie Comer is really great. And I would just really emphasize, because I think the theme can get lost a bit. I listened to this one YouTube review where the guy completely missed what this movie is about, which is, this is based on a true story about this mythologized last duel between two knights. It's the last state-sanctioned duel in French history, so maybe in like Western history. And so that story, which is a true story, has sort of been glamorized as kind of like the end of the age of chivalry, of knights killing dragons for fair ladies. No, like the reality of the tale was that it was about two chauvinistic, vainglorious men taking women for granted in pursuit of their own pride and, you know, money-driven jealousies. And that's like a really strong theme. It's a theme that, you know, again, connects through to the contemporary Me Too era, the sort of, you know, way that abortion and other women's personal, you know, sexual identity or whatnot is being legislated by usually a male system. there's a lot there. It doesn't take advantage of what was on the table. And, yeah. and therefore, to me, it was frustrating and it was long. Ultimately, only recommended to people that are like genre enthusiasts, middle age type of story, yeah. which I am. But
you
even
recommend
I,
it to yourself.
This is not in my top 20 in a fairly weak year.
I don't recommend it at all. I'll just throw it. I guess maybe we'll talk about it more at length next month. But I, as I mentioned at the top, I saw the new Paul Thomas Anderson movie, Licorice Pizza. Spoiler alert, I loved it. Hopefully you guys will get a chance to see it and we'll talk about it more in depth. I thought the performances were great. The aesthetics were great. For me, this was kind of just like a cross between Boogie Nights and Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. Not as good as either one of those movies, in my opinion, but chews off a bit of both. Much more Jewish than I expected. We'll get into that next month, I'm sure, me and Sammy.
What can you tell John to get him excited about this movie? Because it has too much coming of age right now for him.
Yeah, so. Really just, it's a complete hangout movie. I love the vibe of it. I thought the performances were amazing. Two actors that I don't even think either of them are actors, really. And I just couldn't believe how good their chemistry was. It's a coming of age like romance movie. And I just thought it was a lot of fun. It does meander a bit, I think, in the second and third act. So that's kind of why I don't think it's like a perfect movie. But the music is great. The vibe is great. I had a lot of fun. And I hope you guys will, too, when you eventually get a chance to see it. I
do like a good hangout movie, even if coming of age is my thing. So hopefully they'll offset each other and I can just enjoy it.
A few others from November you want to
share? I'd say the only one that I wanted to mention that I got a chance to catch up with is Jagged. This is the new documentary on HBO Max.
Allison Klayman.
Yes, about Alanis Morissette. Back in, I think it was in July, I talked about a documentary on HBO Max about Woodstock 99. That was the first in this series of documentaries produced by The Ringer that were going to be about music, and Jagged now is the second. And kind of weird, they came out with one over the summer, then you didn't hear anything about them for a while. Now they're putting out one a week. So Jagged came out in mid-November, and since then they've had releases of a DMX documentary and a Kenny G documentary, which I haven't seen either of those two yet. I like music documentaries. I'll probably watch them. But the Alanis Morissette one I was looking forward to, because I am a fan of her and her music, and especially Jagged Little Pill, which was her big breakout album in the mid-90s. It was, I think they said, the second highest grossing album of the 90s, and one of the highest grossing solo female albums of all time. The Woodstock 99 documentary was I think better made. It was sort of more urgent. There was sort of we're talking about with Spencer versus Jackie, there was a sort of a point to the Woodstock documentary, which was all this stuff was foreseeable and still exists, that kind of drove to this horrible event. And Jagged just sort of felt like, hey, remember that lady that sang real good? She's pretty cool, right?
But doesn't that sort of fit into The Ringer's punching out a documentary about another figure every week? I just feel it sort of ends up leading into that, which is it's like a 30 for 30 with not as imaginative topics.
Yeah, that's exactly what it felt like. So I felt like it was fine. Alanis Morissette pretty much disowned it shortly before its release. And she's interviewed extensively. She doesn't hold back. She comes across very thoughtful about a lot of subjects. She said that it was not the project she agreed to participate in, and that she thought that they were trying to be lurid about certain details. And I just didn't really pick up on what that was referring to. I don't really know if we're going to get more info there.
I didn't read into that. Allison Klayman is a friend of mine from when we were in Beijing.
I didn't know that.
Back in the day, to go to Chabad dinners together and whatnot. She was a stringer for some media in Beijing back in the day. And that's how, therefore, eventually she did a story when she was being a stringer on that famous Chinese avant-garde artist, who then she made a documentary about him based on her reporting on him. And that's
that Ai Weiwei?
Ai Weiwei made her into this, it kind of documentary-esque. That I haven't followed her since, and I think I wish her happy birthday on Facebook. That's about the extent of our friendship. But it sounds like you have a relationship with the artist, and if I had, I would certainly check it out as well.
I think that's it. If you're a fan of Alanis Morissette, I guess you need to take her warning with a grain of salt, But I feel if you're a fan, you'll like it. Although I will say, I did watch it. I asked my wife, do you want to watch this? And she was no, I don't really care about Alanis Morissette that much. I was okay, fine. So great. I can just watch it. So I started watching it. She came down 15 or 20 minutes into it. And she just sat there and she watched the whole rest of it. She's I actually really like that. I was okay. Yeah, so she had no connection to the artist and liked it. I have a connection to the artist and thought it was just fine.
I don't know if these movies are related to Jagged. I think they're a bit more thematically contiguous with Spencer. But there's a few others that I caught up with this November that I want to share with you as well.
Last night in Soho, I think I told you this just before we got on, that I'm looking over my notes. I was like, oh, wow, this is kind of the same issues I had with Spencer, but a very different movie, which is Last Night in Soho, Edgar Wright's movie, has one of my favorite working actresses, Thomasin McKenzie, in the lead. The story is that she's a teenager who's trying to fulfill her mother's failed dream by moving to the big city, going to fashion school, and she's fascinated by the 60s, so she's always kind of glamorizing them in her head. And then at some point she starts having these kind of waking dreams, or literally dreams, that she is seeing the life that sort of a peer of hers, another young woman, the life that that young woman was living in the 60s. And that young woman ends up having sort of a really challenging life as she's trying to make it in the swinging 60s in London. And therefore Thomasin McKenzie's contemporary figure also starts having a very difficult run of things. The movie is a critique of big city illusions, the valorization of the 1960s, the legacies that our parents have for us, and how, you know, those don't always really work out for the next generation. You know, great theme to make a movie out of. And Edgar Wright, good director, and a lot of the showiness, kind of in the same way that Spencer's filmed well, a lot of like the showiness of Last Night in Soho is really fun, particularly in the first half. The problem is, once the tension for McKenzie's lead gets worse and worse, and she doesn't know what's real and what's a dream, and, you know, the other people at fashion school are all mean, she just becomes this frantic one-note. Frankly, I use the term, I want to use the term sensitively, but she becomes sort of just this like frantic one-note mentally ill character of a person, and not an actual living, breathing character. And you can tell, like, you can tell just the script gets worse. All she's asked to do in the second half of the movie is run into taxis that keep on almost hitting her. And eventually they do hit a character, you know, and she going like, oh, am I losing my mind? Do I have to like move back to the village? And it just descends into this, wow, this person's gone completely crazy. And oh, what's it called in bad horror movies? Jump scares, you know, just lots of jump scares. And it just, it completely loses the ball. So I think the themes that were on the table at the beginning are movie worthwhile themes that we've seen other movies tackle as well, but didn't do it for me here. And I would tell people to skip, unfortunately, Last Night in Soho. Violent is a much lower prestige movie, fully about a woman's anxiety. Olivia Munn, she's a headliner in Violet. The director of Violet is Justine Bateman, who you may know because her brother is a more famous actor, and she was an actress back in the 80s. So apparently this is kind of her semi-autobiographical story, and Olivia Munn also says like she sort of identifies with it. Basically, Olivia Munn plays this woman in Hollywood, producer, and she just suffers intense anxiety throughout the entire movie. So like every time something is happening, there's this voice that's narrated by a man, which is supposed to be the voice inside her head, constantly casting doubt and making her second guess every decision she makes in life. And so the movie is on the surface, you know, very attractive, successful power player who seems to be kind of going through life success after success, but actually internally she has this like major anxiety. It doesn't work because of two very, very blatant reasons. It's not a movie I can recommend because one, the director, Justine Bateman, makes the stylistic choice to sort of constantly interrupt the movie with pictures of like animals getting tortured, or like throwing text on the screen in like blaring fluorescent pink. All of this, I think, is a way of trying to capture anxiety, but it just becomes overwhelming and distracting. And then number two, every single character in the movie, it looks like a teenage high school production. Every character in the movie is cardboard cutout stereotype. So like her mean boss is like the obviously mean boss, or her boyfriend is the like incredibly sympathetic, good looking, like Hollywood boyfriend. Or like, I won't go too much further about it, but the characters were Bateman being like, okay, I have this lead. I've thought about her a lot. I got a Hollywood A-lister to play her. Now just get me a bunch of like D-listers and script writer, just come up with like some lines for them very quickly. Good enough time watching, but it's not a worthwhile movie that I'd recommend to anyone. I would tell people to skip Language Lessons. Language Lessons was getting some buzz. The story in a nutshell, it's a Corona movie. So it's the guy from The League. He's this rich American guy. And then there's his Spanish teacher living in Costa Rica, who's also the director of the movie, credit to her. And the entire movie is the two of them speaking on something like Zoom to each other because she's teaching him Spanish. And the two of them both have a lot of personal traumas that happened to them. So first, like she's coaching him through his personal traumas, and then he's coaching her through her personal traumas. Non-sexual friendship between a man and a woman that grows up by speaking on Zoom to someone, I guess, over an extended period of time. It doesn't do anything with that conceit. Like, if you did you see the movie Searching a few years ago?
Yeah, I did.
So I really liked Searching. I know.
Oh, did you? Okay.
I think Searching does so much with that conceit of everything is the screen or everything is a cell phone or everything is the computer. Yeah. This movie literally made just by filming like for a long Zoom conversation, you know, but it doesn't kind of play with it like Searching did. And then the actual drama of this movie is, you know, it's like a soap opera-esque melodrama. Like particularly the guy from the league who plays like, you know, the one role besides the woman, he's just very flat. There's been a lot of critical love for Language Lessons. I think it's like 90% plus on Rotten Tomatoes. I don't get it. It's not a movie I would recommend anyone check out, really.
Curious to see what I've had to say about it, because I think he liked it a little bit more than you did. But barring a conversation with him, I don't know if it's going to jump up ahead of what is, you know, a pretty long backlog now.
Yeah. So let me give you two for your backlog that I would say push toward the front. One of them is Boiling Point. It's a restaurant version of a high-pressured Men at Work movie.
We talked about that a little bit. Other examples of that. Yeah.
Yeah. And then the other bit here, which works because it's all set in a posh restaurant in London, is that it was a one-shot movie. So the entire movie is on one shot, which if you like that sort of conceit, I think we spoke about this, where like you don't really like it unless it really plays to it. It easily works in this movie because it's happening in real time in a restaurant where like there's very little elbow room. So
It's hit or miss for me. I liked 1917. We talked about that a little bit earlier, funnily enough. But Birdman, I was not a fan of. It depends on how it's executed and thematically and stuff.
Well, this is even more claustrophobic, which I think one shot lends to the claustrophobia. This is...
Yeah, probably true.
But the main thing happening in Boiling Point, by the suggestion of the title, is all the characters, particularly the lead who does a wonderful job, all the acting is on point, and all the characters are dealing with like heavy trauma. So like one guy's doing drugs, one guy's an alcoholic, one guy's kid is like breaking down, one person's like not washing their, you know, like there's all these basically traumas happening in a restaurant context. So it makes for a really fun watch. I would say the third act, they play up the dramas, just the tensions just get overly crazy by the third act until the movie just sort of boom, it ends on you. For someone who likes that kind of high pressured people at work, you know, I like it a bit more than The Guilty, the Jake Gyllenhaal movie that we discussed earlier this year.
I enjoyed that.
The Guilty has more of a plot than this one does. You know, this has people that are very tense and were in a restaurant. But this one is a bit more, it's a bit richer, so to speak. So I like it a bit more. The other one I liked even more, I think it might've been my favorite movie of this month, right below King Richard. And that is Seven Prisoners. It is a documentary-esque expose, socio-political scandal that takes place everywhere around the world, I think including in the US, but particularly where this movie is set. The movie is set in Sao Paulo, about how poor rural Brazilian villagers are sort of tricked into coming to the big city, Sao Paulo, the capital, and then they're basically made into urban slaves, like modern day slavery. The lead, who's one of the villagers, is just fantastic. The bad guy, so to speak, who's given a ton of humanity, he's a very famous Brazilian actor. He plays in 300, the Persian emperor in 300. Oh, I wasn't familiar with him, but he's like the male Brazilian actor, I think, who sort of...
Yeah, he is. He had a small role on Lost that everybody hated.
He's really good. What the movie really is about is the fall of man. I won't go into too much because it's a bit of a spoiler, but it's about how brought into the system, you're tricked, you're taken advantage of, and then you can end up taking advantage of others as well. Not a documentary, but it's almost like the best kind of documentary in the sense that it's so hard-hitting. It's about something so, you know, today that we should be more aware of and very dramatic at the same time. So Seven Prisoners, I would strongly recommend. And then the last movie I'll leave you with is, it's now on Netflix, so people can catch up with it. We referenced it briefly earlier, The Power of the Dog.
Yeah, and I'm like halfway through it.
Okay, so I'm curious. Tell me what you think so far. I found the first half pretty flat and the second half.
I'm like totally loving it, but I'm like a huge, huge Jane Campion fan. To me, it's like doing a lot of things I really liked about Passing, weirdly enough, where it's just sort of like, just sort of hanging out and getting on each other's nerves, which like, I'm into it. That's
pretty much what they do, yeah. So did you get to the piano part of the movie yet?
Yes.
Okay, that's one of my favorite scenes this year. The scene with the piano and the banjo clashing with each other.
I just finished it and I loved that scene. I think that's probably why I'm like, riding a high talking about the movie right now.
But that is a really, really good, that scene like captures to me. I do think the second half of the movie, really picks up, and there's this like very heavy violin or maybe banjo music whenever the movie wants to really pick up. And like the entire last act of this movie is just this heavy banjo music, like pushing the plot forward. I found the first half way too slow.
Okay.
I completely didn't like Jesse Plemons' character. He's just so flat.
He's very flat.
He just has nothing really to do in the movie. Cumberbatch is good. I don't think he's great. I think he's good.
I like him. I don't normally respond to him much as an actor. If I hadn't started it, or we hadn't had it kind of on the agenda to at least touch on, I might have said it was one of my anticipated December titles, because I guess technically we're in December right now. That was the one thing where it's just like, I really don't know if I'm a Cumberbatch fan, but he's working for me so far, so pretty good. So
what the movie is, so people know, Benedict Cumberbatch plays a 19th century Montana rancher who has a hard time coming to terms when his brother gets married to a widow, and his brother and the widow are played by the real life couple, Jesse Plemons and Kirsten Dunst. And then the key character in the movie besides Cumberbatch is the son of the widow, who's played by, I recognize him from X-Men.
It's Cody Smith McPhee.
He's really good here. You know, I think he dominates the second half of the movie. So once you get there, you'll see. Cumberbatch is good. The son is good as well. The director, as John, as you referenced, is very well known. She directed The Piano, which is like one of the most loved movies of the 90s.
Ever seen The Piano?
I saw it with my parents when I was way too young to watch a movie like that. And it was like a movie they were watching on Saturday night, you know, and I snuck down to watch it with them. So I have a very the movie came out when I was 8. So like I have like a 9-year-old's memory of The Piano as this very heavy, I mean, it is a heavy movie, I think, no matter what age you are. The Power of the Dog only really gets going for me once they bring a piano into the movie. So I thought it was kind of funny that once they introduce a piano into this movie sort of takes off. The second half of the movie is better than the first half, I think, probably for most, you know, people who aren't as okay with, as you said, Western, slow, sitting around. So maybe that's like Campion's thing. Like she drops a piano on you when she wants like her movies to really get going. Because my memory of The Piano is that obviously the piano is called The Piano, but like the piano in the movie only shows up also, I think, kind of halfway through. And then once it does, it kind of really pushes things into high gear. So maybe that's like her thing. My major problem with Power of the Dog is the ending.
Yeah.
And I like to think that I'm someone who's like good at catching what movies are doing and good at knowing where things are going or whatnot. I was so blindsided by Power of the Dog that I literally had to read articles. I don't think Wikipedia was enough for me. I had to read one or two articles explaining the ending and then go back and watch the last few minutes over again. And so none of this is spoiler, just to say what's happening on the screen is obvious, but I didn't understand what you need to understand. And maybe it's an indictment of myself, but I also think to some extent, it's a bit too oblique, maybe, the storytelling. But maybe we'll catch up with Av and talk some dog at the end of December.
Unless there's anything else, do you want to do a quick classics corner?
I'm so in the dog, so to speak, for 2021 movies. I did not even dip into classics corner. But
oh my gosh.
Yeah, I know, right? I'm in contemporary corner right now.
Fair enough. I mean, it was a good month for that. I haven't watched much outside of that, but I did catch up with the Lord of the Rings, Fellowship of the Ring. On my other podcast, It's the Pictures, we are going to be doing a 20th anniversary retrospective on that movie. It's going to be probably dropping a week or two after you listen to this.
This wasn't the first time.
I saw it when it came out in theaters. I saw it probably a dozen or more times on TV or on DVD back when I was in high school and college. But I don't think I've watched it in probably going on 10 years. So it's been a long time. I wasn't sure in my mind, if I was going to respond as well to it as I did, obviously, back then. But it's still really good. I don't think the first one's my favorite. Everybody kind of has their own opinions on that. I kind of like the second one the best. It does sort of lend itself well to even though we're only going to be covering the first one on the podcast, and I only needed to watch the first one, almost immediately I turned the second one on. I didn't get as far into that, but I got into cramming mode for There Will Be Pod here. Finish up two and probably move on to three before I dive deep into December's titles. That check out It's the Pictures if you want to hear me really, really go on about, and my co-host, who is a Lord of the Rings expert, about that movie.
Peter Jackson is past week is in the process of releasing like a
this like big Beatles docu-series on Disney Plus, right?
And I think the first one was already released. And so if you're hankering
the music documentary guy,
if you're hankering for, you know, multi-part Peter Jackson fare, if you're hankering for music fare, and you're going for a 2021 fare, you could
really checks all my boxes, I guess, so to speak, right?
I want to hear you come back next month and say, guys, the number 1, 2, and 3 best movies of the year is all Peter Jackson's Beatles documentaries. 3 or maybe even 5. I don't know. But I know
that. I thought I heard 6, but I could be wrong. I haven't been like super tuned into that.
Your top 10. Those
6 movies.
Parts were, yeah.
Passing the card counter, of course.
No. And maybe The Power or maybe The Dog. We'll see how
The Power, maybe The Dog. We'll see. Yeah. We'll see. Yeah.
John, I'll catch you later.
This was fun. We'll talk to you later.